Welcome back to another episode of Tell Me Something Weird. We're a weekly podcast where I, Eric Johnson, dog owner, sub eater, beer drinker, tell you a story about
William Miller and the Millerites.
To my effervescent co-host,
Jody Arnold, who is going to tell you all about the legend of Elizabeth Bathory. Bathory. I'm reading that upside down, which sounds super interesting.
The Blood Countess.
The Blood Countess.
Yeah.
I'm super excited for this one.
Hi, weirdos.
Yeah. It's been 2 weeks.
It has. You were on vacay.
Yeah, much, much needed vacay. And I don't want to say I'm super bummed to be here.
Yeah, you are.
But I am.
You've been butthurt about it since you got back.
I've been butthurt about it since before I left Phoenix.
I know.
it was super tough to leave. But of course, you know, like part of it was that I, you know, was leaving my SO behind,
mm-hmm.
You know, and that's always tough.
Not your SOB.
SOB? Son of a bitch?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
SO is pretty close to that.
Yeah. Right. Well, I mean, one letter off, completely different meanings.
Yes.
I think we can all, well, maybe not always completely different meanings. In this case, definitely.
SOC is another one. Son of a carpenter.
Or SOPM.
Son of a
preacher man.
That's a good one. You didn't have that one written down either.
No, that was straight from old Mr. Johnson's noggin.
So how, you want to tell us anything about your... What were you doing in Phoenix? Why don't you tell everybody the adorable story about a family who actually likes each other?
Well, I mean, I don't know how if we want to go quite that far because we only do this one time a year, you know, where we actually all get together. But what we do is...
My frame of reference makes that pretty special.
Right.
Trust
so,
me.
So what we do is we're all of us... are, you know, obviously we're from Wisconsin. I mean, I don't know if that's obvious to our Japanese listeners, but we're all from Wisconsin. We're all Brewers fans. And so each year we go out to Phoenix to follow the Brewers around to different spring training stadiums and watch some baseball.
Was Ryan Braun there?
I actually didn't see Ryan Braun the whole weekend. He doesn't play very much in spring training, and he's pretty reclusive when he's actually on the field. So
he is?
Yeah. Yeah. He's not a very good, like, and I don't know if it's, if he's any better about it in, like, the early weeks of spring training, but, like, he's never out there, like, signing autographs. And that's one of the reasons why you go to spring training is, like, none of the games count. Everybody's super relaxed. You know, like, players and coaches are generally, super approachable. They always come over and sign autographs. There's one of the Brewers coaches, Ed Cedar, he always goes out when he goes out to coach third base. You always see him go out there with a bunch of baseballs in his back pocket, and between batters, he'll hunt for kids and toss the baseballs to the kids.
That's so pretty freaking cute.
It's super cute.
Oh, you know? Are there a lot of kids who go to stuff like that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, I bet with their dads. I feel like that's a real father-son type thing, which is what you're doing.
Which is what we're doing, yeah.
How did you guys start that? When?
Well, I forget exactly when. It was around the time my dad retired and moved out to Tucson. And so it was around then, because it was kind of like, you know, it was an excuse for all of us to go to Arizona at the end of winter, mm-hmm. watch baseball, which we all really enjoy, and spend time together. Mm-hmm. And as it turns out, Eric has really fallen in love with Phoenix. Mm-hmm. I feel like I have a pretty realistic picture of it, especially after this trip.
Yeah, you've seen the not pretty parts.
Yeah, I mean, it is like there are parts of it which are just seem like almost magical, you know. Like this time of year, the orange trees are blossoming, and it just like fills the air with this like fragrance, you mm-hmm. know. And it's just like when you're in these like kind of quiet neighborhoods with a bunch of orange trees and moving around, it really is like
it's pretty idyllic.
Yeah, but we also stayed at a hotel in a little more colorful part of town. we stayed. I only stayed one night at this hotel because we had some of Sandy's family rescued us from kind of a rough neighborhood.
Yeah,
but
out there on Dunbar. What was the name of the room?
Oh, Van Buren.
Van Buren.
Yeah.
Dunbar, you know.
Yeah, it's pretty close. Yeah. We were right down there by, you know, the state prison.
Jalopy.
The Jalopy Jungle. Cactus Jack's. The Blue Moon, which was the strip club right across the street from the hotel. So it was just like, it was a stretch of just, you know, like those real rough car lots that you mm-hmm. see out west, you know, that are just surrounded by like rusty chain link and barbed wire.
Yeah. And does anybody ever buy a car there?
I feel like they must, you know?
Yeah.
But I feel like it's a lot of like straight cash.
Yeah.
Or other things perhaps. I'm sure it, you know, like, probably operates much like we're used to. It just looks different than we're used to, you know?
Yeah.
But it definitely was a pretty rough part of town, you know? Like, I mean, you could just tell it's like, you know, it's very central Phoenix, you know, just north of the airport. And it's a poor neighborhood. But overall, like the area is just phenomenal. And actually, I don't know how many baseball fans we have listening, but so I won't go too crazy into all the stuff that happened baseball wise. But I really dug it's the stadium that's shared by the Dodgers and the White Sox, which is called Camelback Ranch in Glendale. Super pretty, like. Uses a ton of all the paneling was like that corroded steel paneling.
That's neat.
Everything was kind of like this kind of gold and beige kind of color. Like it was just aesthetically, it was, I think that's my favorite spring training baseball park that I've been to.
Wow.
Oh yeah. I thought you were going to come at me with a follow up.
Yeah, me too.
But we also spent a little time at the place called the Westgate Entertainment District, which is kind of had a Vegas kind of feel to it.
The photo you had sent me one day when we were having one of our conversations about Eau Claire versus AZ.
Yeah, I was like...
Anywhere in AZ, really.
Yeah, but specifically I was like... Here's what it looks like when you have a thriving economy. The Westgate Entertainment District.
And then I want to dispute that. It's like, damn, I do like a good handbag. And I could see from that stock photo, I could have found what I was looking for.
Oh, undoubtedly. Yeah. But it's just on one hand, like Westgate is sort of like an unapologetic, like capitalist, like money extractor.
Yeah, that's, and it looks entirely like that to me.
But there's a couple of really good restaurants in it. I had lunch at the Yard House, which is just like, you know, it's sort of like, you know what the menu kind of reminded me of? If we're going to reframe this in Eau Claire terms.
Can I guess?
Yeah.
Bug Eye Betty's.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, yeah. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, because it's like, it was sort of like kind of, I don't want to say necessarily like standard pub fare, but kind of that, you know, like a lot of burgers, sandwiches, things like that, but done in a really unique way.
Yeah, and that's how I feel about Bug Eye Betty's.
Yeah. Yep. So, so it was cool. Like, and it was such a relief to be like having lunch and a beer outside. Like, and I know, like, maybe that's not a big priority to a lot of people, but like, that's something that it's very meaningful to me.
You would love to live somewhere where you could just go out on your porch every day.
Yeah.
And just know what to expect with the weather every day for the most part.
Yeah.
It's either going to be hot or like more hot.
Well, like I was out there, you know, I mean, it got into the, it was 90 some one day, but it was like in the 80s the rest of the time, you know.
Which,
like,
is pretty tolerable.
It's, yeah. Well, especially out there because, like, you know, you're not, when it's like 90 degrees out there, you know, it's warm, but like your fingers aren't like sticking together.
Yeah.
You know, so like, I don't know. I mean, a lot is said about like, oh, it's a dry heat and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's like hot is hot, but there's something to be said about not having the humidity with it. Like it is much more comfortable, especially you go into the shade. If it's a 90 degree day, you go into the shade, like a little gentle breeze blowing. It's like perfect. If you're in the sun, it's going to be hot, you know, but. That's why they build shade.
That sounds like something I'd say. Well, guess where I went?
Oh, I don't care.
The audacity.
Where did you go?
To the Twin Cities Auto Show. Have you ever been to that?
No, I've seen it advertised a bunch, but I've never actually been.
Well,
where is it?
It's in the Minneapolis Convention Center.
Oh, wow. Right in it.
In it. And it was quite a delight because the last time I had been there was when I was first married. And that person, I'm not even sure why we went. I think it was to collect every free thing you could get. Which was so great because Mike and I went and there was this room of custom vehicles. So it was, oh man, there was some cool shit. There were some trucks that were made to look like ones from the 80s. So they had like the kind of pinstriping of the orange and white. I don't know if you're into that at all with like the white walled tires
now,
and stuff.
What I'll say is like, I don't like, I'm not into cars as much as I don't know things about them. But when I go to an auto show, I can be like, hey, that's a great looking car.
Yes. And this was a whole room of like aftermarket upgrades and stuff like that. So there was this guy there though with his kids, and in the middle of everything, he was putting batteries into this free flashlight he had gotten. And his wife was like, "Do you need to be doing that right now?" She was like really pissed about it. But here's what I love about the auto show. You walk around, you get to sit in most of the cars. There's some concept cars there. And, like, I love Lincolns, so I can just sit in a new Lincoln, see what that feels like. Then they have this thing where they do a Jeep experience where they take you on a course. Like, you drive straight up. It's, like, completely straight up. And then there's this other part where the Jeep, like, is the wheels are up in the air, you know, both ways. It's pretty freaking fun. The whole ride probably only lasts 2 minutes, but...
I had a similar experience actually in Phoenix. It's the folks that I was staying with, one of them is a retired firefighter,
uh-huh.
And he's got a golf cart that's all that's all done up like a fire truck.
He does?
Yeah. And
Now, come on, a golf cart is not quite like a Jeep, though.
Well, maybe not for most people. But Sandy and I took it to the grocery store to get some booze one night. And I had the tires barking on that thing a little bit.
Barking. And then there's like, well, Mike was wondering where the new caravans were. He was like, I feel seriously ripped that there's no caravans.
Well, what, like Dodge Caravan? You know what? I'm sure this is out there on the internet somewhere. I want to see like a car enthusiast, like a restoration enthusiast, like take like an early 90s, like a 93 Dodge Caravan and just like fully restore it. Not like soup it up or anything. Just like factory restore. Well, I feel like Mike would have been all over that.
He would. And he was...
Or maybe even if they like hot rotted it out, you know, like had like...
Yeah.
Kind of jack it up in the back a little bit, you know, put some big like I don't know what they call them, like those big like drag tires or whatever.
So we get in there. This will perfectly illustrate our differences. And I'm looking over and I see VW, Lincoln, and it's the new cars. And this is not... I mean, there were those other rooms were for the cars that were souped up or whatever. Then they had like the Batmobile. They had Kit from Hasselhoff's show that I'm forgetting. Knight Rider. They had Kit there. The Scooby-Doo, the Mystery Machine. It was pretty cool. So, oh, kitty.
That's pretty rad.
Oh, look, he just popped his head up out of nowhere. So, yeah, chew those cords. I want to see what happens. So it's like you walk in the main room, and it was all the sea of beautiful luxury cars, and that's right where I went. So Mike, like, went along, and then suddenly he's like, where's the Fords? And it was like such a perfect.
Where's the minivan section?
Yeah, he was like, where's the caravans? So then I posted something about that on Facebook and somebody said, oh, they're called Pacificas now.
Oh, sure. Right,
yeah,
right.
So it's not a Dodge Caravan anymore.
It's a Chrysler Pacifica.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, we got that squared away. So anyway, the Twin Cities Auto Show is pretty cool. We went there and he's like, oh, I'll buy your ticket. So I walk up to him and he went and bought the tickets and we're going to go into the auto show and he hands me a coupon. And I was like, what's this? And he's like, it's your ticket. I'm like, no, it's a coupon. And he's like, oh, I'm sorry. I thought I bought you a ticket. So then he regretfully now just stood there and it was like a really long walk. So then I said, oh, okay, I'll go get myself a ticket. So then I went and bought a ticket and used the coupon. And I kept thinking to myself, if this were a first date.
This is not going well for this guy.
But it wasn't a first date.
Right.
So,
you know,
I made
you're
a
right.
Few
at that point, you know what you're in for. Yeah. You know what you're getting already. You've accepted the, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. you know what you bought. You can't be just like.
Right. It's like, oh, okay. So you gave me a coupon pretending you thought it was a ticket.
Right. And then...
Oh, I didn't know.
Okay, well, I'm going to hang here while you go.
Just going to stand.
Well, I pulled a straight-up jack move on Sandy at the ballpark.
What did you do?
So we decided we were going to get some Italian ice, and we went to sample some of the flavors, right? And so this chick gives us the... You know, like two spoons with like two of the flavors. And I just like cashed the one. I was like, well, guess you're not tasting cherry, Sandy. Sorry about that.
Well, she could have given you each one.
Yeah. I mean.
Was the other flavor pineapple?
It was tie-dye, which was blue lemonade and something else. I forget.
Mm-hmm. Was there a coconut or something like that?
Yeah, there probably was. I don't know. I didn't really. I wasn't that choosy.
So before we start recording,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, we are. You know, getting into our thing. I want to just have a little chat on here about Jason. Jason is somebody you know that was trying to bring me something, and I wasn't there.
Right.
And somehow or another, he, you know, left me. I don't understand why he couldn't have just delivered what he was trying to deliver to me, but it didn't work out that way.
Well, there are rules, and I guess that's all I'll say about that.
Yeah. So it was like I've had a TV leaning against my door.
Right, but but we had sample buttons.
Yes. And it's like, so, okay, I guess those needed to be signed for. So he, you know, does what he does, and I'm like, okay, I got to go get these damn buttons. So I go to the place, and I didn't look closely enough at the slip that Jason left. And the slip would have indicated to me a different place to go, which would sure, not have made sense to me.
Right. Yeah, that wouldn't have made sense to me either.
Yeah.
You know, but
so I go to the place, which has very unusual store hours. And I walked in there, and I was like, oh, my God. This is the worst smelling place. The people inside of it at that time.
Yeah, and it's like real cramped and real dirty.
It's and there was a guy at the checkout that at the end of it all, the guy helping him was like, oh, well, this was delivered last week. And the guy was like, oh, it was? Oh, yeah, that's right, it was. This guy was looking everywhere for his package.
I was at home and I forgot to look for it. Okay.
And then it was two guys after that, which did not have anything filled out correctly. So then it was me, and they go and look for my thing. And they're like, oh, you have to go to this other place. And I'm like, what? Okay. So I go to the other place. I go in there, and I give my name. They're like, well, we don't have anything under your name. I said, do you have it under Tell Me Something Weird? And they're like, oh, yeah. Jason told us about this one when he brought it, you know, like it was a good old story for him. So I was like, curse you, Jason.
Telling people about our podcast who might not have otherwise heard of it.
I mean, I appreciated where he brought the thing. Yeah. That was a much more pleasant experience.
Yeah.
But, you know, Jason, if you're going to go rogue like that, you should have included that when you were chatting with me about this situation.
Just like, hey, by the way, BTW, going rogue.
Yeah, I'm going rogue. When I write this thing on here, you follow it to the T. And then we passed the Dunkin' Donuts, and I told Mike I was going to do something because he thinks Glazers from Quick Trip are the best. I'm like, no, they're not.
Well, I think we have established how we feel about Glazers on this show. And just to recap for any new listeners, Glazers are barely enough to qualify as donuts to satisfy like a craving for donuts.
So I go in the line at Dunkin' Donuts and I just said, yeah, can I get a donut? Just to see what they do. The guy was like, sure. And I'm like, what kind do you want? And then I'm like, make it two. And then he's like, okay, what kind? And I said, oh, you know, the old... And I just kind of left it.
So, what did he press you, or did he just?
I said two glazed, and
yeah, give me a couple glazers.
Yeah. And this guy was so wonderfully tolerant because I was kind of effing with him.
Yeah.
I mean, everything I was doing was the most generic, annoying shit, and you know what? I'm gonna write this down because they were so delightful there. And then I thought, well, of course, who freaking works at a donut shop that's not goddamn happy?
Right. Yeah. I mean, you really are. You're not dealing with like people's necessities. You know, it's like the people
or
are
even
coming in
food, like a meal.
Right. Yeah. You're just like, hey,
I got what you need.
You know what you're here for.
Maybe you feel guilty about it, but
so let me tell you one reason why I'm not thoroughly depressed about being back in Wisconsin. That means I can have a crisp, cold, refreshing Montucky cold snack.
I've had a few.
I can tell. I think we can all tell.
You can't get those in AZ.
Not yet. I'm sure they're working on it.
If you can get it everywhere, it's not so special.
I have a feeling maybe our friends at Montucky might disagree. But for now, you can't get it everywhere, and so it does make it special. And I am just delighted to have... I'll have to search through. I've got a couple of pictures. I was wearing a Montucky t-shirt at one of the ballparks.
Did anybody say anything to you about it?
Not a one.
Well, of course they don't have it there.
Yeah, right.
You're just breaking people in.
Yeah, right.
They're like, what's that horse motif about?
Yeah. It's a Montucky cold snack. I actually, it's not entirely true. I did have to try to explain to people what a cold snack was. It's like, right, come on, you're a grown up.
Right. Get it together.
Yeah, pull it together. They let you drive a car. You can't figure out what a cold snack is. No, it's great to have a cold snack back in my hand.
So that's your one reason for being happy to be back here.
Yeah, and also there are a lot of other places that have it. Besides Wisconsin. It is just such a Wisconsin day out there, isn't it, to be enjoying this Montucky cold snack? Look at it out there. Look at it. Look at how... You know what I love? You know what I really need to be in Wisconsin is I need the green. It's so I need that lush greenness.
Well, it is just starting spring. Okay.
How long would you say
this?
It's green in Wisconsin. Here, I'm going to count it out for you. We'll say May, June, July, August, September.
5 months.
Yes. Less than half the year. So, sorry. All you people, I'm sorry to have to do this, but I'm invalidating that argument. It is mostly brown here.
Yeah, but some people don't look good in green.
So anyways, with my with my delicious Montucky cold snack, I'm about to tell you something weird.
You're going first.
William Miller was a prosperous farmer. He was actually also he's described as a Baptist lay preacher, you know, so he's like an amateur preacher, you know. Not full-time, but you know, like he dabbles in the preaching a little bit. He was also considered himself a student of the Bible. He was from northeastern New York, and Miller's jam was studying the symbolic meaning of the prophecy of Daniel, and especially he really honed in on Daniel 8:14. Which says, unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. And that's a passage that gets used for a lot of biblical prophecy people. That's a very important passage, Daniel 8:14.
Wow.
So they call it the 2,300 day prophecy. So 2,300 days. So... There's some controversy.
Thanks for mansplaining that. 2,300 is 2,300.
Well, sorry. I mean, I just the way it's worded, I wanted to be clear about it.
Oh, okay. I mean, I really appreciate that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not necessarily for you.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's better. That sounds better.
It's for all the other dummies out there. So there's some controversy about what cleansing the sanctuary actually means, and
Sounds dirty. It's gotta, douching.
It's got to cleanse that sanctuary. or it's like washing the sheets. So cleansing the sanctuary to Miller represented like the earth's earth destruction by fire during the second coming of Christ. You know, and that's sort of like the the Christ, like the Revelation Christ coming in on the white horse with the laser beam eyes and the flaming sword. You know, like one of my two favorite Jesuses.
Yeah.
Next to Jesus riding the dinosaur with a lightsaber. There's a thing called the year-day method in biblical prophecies, you know, which is where one day, as described in the Bible, is actually 1 year of time. So the question then is, if one day is a year, then when does that 2,300-day cycle start? And Miller, by pouring through the Bible, figured it out. They're in 457 BC, Artaxerxes I of Persia issued a decree to rebuild Jerusalem. And calculating from that, from 457, that would put the end of that 2,300-year period, that 2,300-day period, would end about 1843. See what's going on here?
Yeah. Not going to tell you nothing else about it.
Okay. So Miller put together his ideas, and he put his conclusions together in a 20-point document. And Article 15 of that document said, quote, "I believe that the second coming of Jesus Christ is near, even at the door, even within 21 years, on or before 1843. He hung on to this in private for a while. You know, he wasn't like, because he was kind of reserved at first about the prophecy stuff. Like he really didn't want to be like on record of saying like, you know, like this is when it's going to happen. This is like Jesus is coming back now.
Yeah.
Right. Eventually he started kind of sharing it privately with friends and then to some of his like, you know, professional acquaintances, like in the preacher circles, and people were not really responding to it in the way he thought the way he expected them to. Like he expected people to be like, oh, holy shit, you did your homework. Like this is the Jesus is coming back like next year.
Yeah.
You know, like and people were just like, interesting, you know? And Miller wrote, quote, "To my astonishment, I found very few who listened with any interest.
Oh, gee.
Occasionally, one would see the force of the evidence, but the great majority passed it by as an idle tale."
Oh, yeah, nobody cared.
Yeah, he's a little bummed, you know. Well, nobody cared, but one Joshua Vaughn Himes, he cared. His parents had intended for him to be an Episcopal priest, but one of his father's business deals went south and wasn't able to pay for Joshua's education. And so he was apprenticed to a cabinet maker in Massachusetts. So it's like, well, we like, hope you enjoyed school, Josh. Here's a hammer. And 18 years old, he joined a church called the Christian Connection. Which sounds kind of contemporary.
It really does. Sounds like kind of like a mixer.
Yeah.
Where they're meeting people.
In November of 1825, he married Mary Thompson Handy. And the following year was ordained into the ministry. He pastored in several districts in Massachusetts and eventually became pastor of the First Christian Church in Boston in 1830. Where he rose to prominence, reviving a church that was kind of on its way out. He became active in education, temperance, peace, and he was an abolitionist. So it's like this guy's real up and down. Like that's like that's real hit or miss, right?
Yes.
Josh met William Miller in Exeter, New Hampshire in 1839. He was struck by how Miller spoke. Like, you know, like Miller was like he was a great orator, you know, like he's very charismatic. And so Josh Himes invited Miller to speak at the Chardon Street Chapel. It was from those lectures by William Miller that Josh Himes became convinced of the imminent return of Jesus Christ. And so he kept looking for opportunities. He kind of became William Miller's publicist. Like, so he kept looking for places to get William Miller on stage to speak.
Yeah.
In 1840, Himes published and edited the first Millerite newspaper, The Sign of the Times.
That's also very contemporary sounding.
Yeah, kind of. He led in organizing general conferences and camp meetings, which we've definitely talked about camp meetings on the show before, published hundreds of pamphlets as well as the second and third editions of Miller's lectures, organized lecture tours for Miller, and they went as far west as Cincinnati. And they actually, one of their big innovations was they manufactured what was called the Great Tent, which at the time was the largest tent in the United States.
Like a revival kind of tent?
Yeah. Kind of, I mean, just
they
like
just a, made know. Tents?
Yeah,
or was it I just mean, one tent? Or was like, step right up, get your tent?
Well, I mean, they just made it. They had a big tent made, you know?
Like they just had one, though.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I'm sure they had like, I mean, I'm sure at these things there were more than one tent.
Yeah, but they had the biggest tent.
The main one was the biggest tent in the country. They established, during the tours, they established a network of agents, book depots, reading rooms, where they would, you know, start distributing all of this literature. In 1842, he started a second newspaper, The Midnight Cry, in New York City.
And this is edgy.
The Midnight Cry, actually, that sounds like an underground, like, poetry.
It does. Yeah, that's in New York, so you know.
Oh, yeah. It was Joshua Himes's promotion that brought Millerism to a much wider scale. The Millerites knew that they couldn't just have one message blasted out there that's going to connect with everybody. So they actually started issuing or like creating papers that specifically targeted different groups. Like the paper, The Advent Message to the Daughters of Zion, which is targeted towards female readers. The Advent Shield was a little more of an academically oriented paper. Its purpose was to defend the doctrine from the attacks of the enemies, to exhibit the unscriptural position of the opponents, and furnish the truth to those who are ready to receive it. Are you ready to receive it?
I'm feeling pretty ready.
So, Miller was, he was very thorough, he was very methodical, and the main idea for Miller with biblical interpretation was that all scripture was necessary. So anything that's there, like, I mean, and if you think about it, like, if the Bible is the perfect word of God, then why would you skip over anything, right? Like, if it's there, it's there for a reason, you know? And so that was kind of, that was his, you know, kind of his theory. And so he said, if you're looking for prophecy, or, you know, and to understand what the Bible's telling you, you needed to, quote, bring all scriptures together on the subject you wish to know. Then let every word have its proper influence. And if you can form your theory without a contradiction, you cannot be in error.
Well, no.
So, it's applying some logic to this thing, you know?
He is.
You know, like, I mean, he's basically saying, like, you know, the Bible should just, it should stand on its own. Especially, you know, like, if it's
all the perfect word of God. every single word.
I don't know if he's taking into account the fact that it's been like translated a number of times and whatever, but you know.
Right. I mean, there's so much what we weren't going to get into with that.
So, by this theory, comparing scripture with scripture, a person could unlock the meaning of the Bible. We'll just skip ahead to the French Revolution. Well, actually, we'll skip behind to the French Revolution in the 1790s. Because that was one of the factors that, where people started looking at the Bible for prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So looking at it for like a scheme of interpretation, and the concept that that a prophetic day equals a real time year, Bible scholars started. They started studying the time prophecies, like Daniel 8:14. That's what they consider one of the time prophecies. There was also another passage that they took notice of, which was Daniel 7:25, which says, "He will speak against the Most High and oppress His holy people and try to change the set times and the laws. The holy people will be delivered into His hands for a time, times and a half a time."
Well, this is just mumbo jumbo.
So the way they interpret that is the holy people will be delivered into His hands for a year, 2 years, and a half a year.
This is absurd. Oh, okay.
So
somewhere in between there.
So this is a 1260-day prophecy.
Oh my God! Okay.
That initiated the time of the end. So they dated that to the 1790s. You know, so it's all if you notice a pattern with a lot of this biblical prophecy, it's always like just a little bit into the future. You know, it's like right around now.
Yeah.
You know, where it's like
Mr. Rogers was probably the second coming and we just all missed it.
Maybe. Well, would the second coming, like, would he have to, like, would he announce, like, hey, and if somebody, like,
I've wondered about this a lot.
Yeah, if somebody were to announce, like, hey, it's time, I'm here, I'm Jesus, like, who's going to believe him?
It feels like,
well, a number of people, because there's a lot of cults who follow people who claim to be the second coming.
But who would ever know for sure, right? You will never know. So that's why I always just feel like it's Mr. Rogers. He was a good man.
I mean,
who would you rather have?
I mean, Mr. Rogers was. I think you could really make a solid case that he was very Christ-like.
In
his behavior, you know, in the way he did things, this sounds like a paper.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So the French Revolution people, they figured it was going to happen in the 1790s. Miller was appealing to those people who were kind of disillusioned that it didn't happen in the 1790s, right? And so now he's applying his new 2300-day theory to now, you know, like where it's like, hey, it's like that was wrong, but this is right, you know? And the fact that he was kind of reluctant to, you know, to even come forward with a prediction, you know, like I think people were he was so charismatic, so reluctant to like pin down a date. I think people were just really excited for him to like nail something down.
Yeah.
You know, like they're like,
they were cheering for him.
This guy gets it. That's when Miller really started honing in on the Daniel 8:14. There are three things that Miller determined about that passage, that 2,300 symbolic days represented 2,300 real years, and the sanctuary, you know, the cleansing of the sanctuary represents the earth or church, and by...
Which could be anything, the earth.
Well, hang on.
Just okay.
Hang in there with me.
Yes, I'm a little skeptical.
By referring to Peter 3:7, which reads, "But the heavens and earth, which are now by the same word, are kept in store, reserved unto fire against the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men." The 2,300 years ends at the burning of the earth at the second coming of Christ. So that's what that's all.
Okay.
You know, so that like unbelievers are all toast. All literal toast. The problem is there's no specific beginning that's given in the Bible. So Miller had to figure out where to start it. And so he tied it to the 70-week prophecy in chapter 9, where the beginning is given as 70 sevens or 490 days.
There's just too many numbers.
I know.
I mean, it's like, okay, hold on a minute now. I'm going to look here. I mean, are you...
I know. And that's why I kind of hesitated to do the story a little, you know, for a little while. Because, like, it is a lot of numbers. The numbers, don't worry about it. Like, it's just, like...
Ultimately, we're just seeing here how it's like, oh, okay, so now I got to figure out this thing. All right, so right. Like 1 year used to equal this many years, right. But now it's just 1 year. But now I'm going to figure out the beginning, which is like 5 years minus 3 years, then minus two more years plus one.
Right.
Okay.
That's pretty much how biblical prophecy works.
Oh,
you know?
Okay.
It kind of starts with a conclusion and it works in that fashion, to, you know. But I mean... That's what it appears to a person who doesn't necessarily believe in biblical prophecy.
Yeah.
So anyway, so how he got, so that's when he decided that the 490 years were to begin with the command to rebuild Jerusalem. So his calculation figured that that 2,300 day period then would end somewhere between 1843 and 1844.
I do know about that end date, 1844.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to share?
Mm-mm. Yeah, because I'm going to find it.
Okay.
There was a short story I read in class a couple of semesters ago, and you had mentioned the Millerites, but you hadn't talked about the Millerites. But this short story, which I will find the name of, is something you would love. It's these letters that this father is sending his son. And it's a son who has disappeared, and he's fallen into the hands of kind of a revival crowd, which I believe is the Millerites.
Okay.
And there's a big fire, and that the son is never found. So it's a really unresolved story, which is rather sad throughout and how the dad writes it. But it was believed to have been modeled after the Millerites.
Well, there were several groups like this.
Yeah. You know, well, so. Right. So, like, it could have been any of them except for the time period in which this story fell and the end date that was subscribed to.
Sure.
And that one is this one. So that's how I know.
Okay.
It.
So Miller, like, all along is resisting about being specific about the exact time of Christ's return. But he did narrow the time to sometime in the Jewish year, 5604. Quoting
Eric,
"My principles in brief are that Jesus Christ will come again to this earth, cleanse, purify, and take possession of the same with all the saints sometime between March 21, 1843 and March 21, 1844. So as that time approached, Millerite publishing went into high gear. And in May 1843, 21,000 copies of the various Millerite papers were published for distribution each week.
Oh my gosh.
In New York alone, during the period, a 5-month period ending April 1843, 600,000 copies of various publications were distributed. In December of 1843, Himes proposed the publication of 1 million.
Whoa.
Now, Jesus fever was like in full force. Like,
Jesus freaks.
People were like totally on board with this. You know, were just like, hey, Jesus is coming. It's kind of like what I said about like nuclear apocalypse. Like, if it's going to happen, wouldn't you want to see it? It's like, so if Jesus is going to come back and burn the earth, like, wouldn't you want to see it? I would want to see it.
I got to get back to you on that.
Okay. All right. I'm on record. If the world's going to end in like some fiery catastrophe, I would rather see it, even if that means being like burned.
And then wouldn't you think to yourself, holy shit, some of this shit's real.
Maybe.
I mean, if some weird shit came down and there were monsters in the sky or something really weird that's referenced in the Bible and it started to happen, wouldn't you be like, oh my God?
I think my favorite cause of death would be being cut in half by Jesus's lightsaber.
Moving on.
So people started abandoning their houses and farms, giving away all their worldly possessions.
Oh, this is a common thing, too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, who needs stuff when you're going to be raptured up into eternal life in paradise?
Yeah. You've had other stories where people have done this stuff.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
then,
this
then
is
we know
a
what's
going to
happen. Is these people are going to be like,
Now, March 21... comes. March 21, 1844 comes. You know, the end of so that whole year happens and nothing, no Jesus. So March 21, 1844, no Jesus. But it didn't really affect the movement. You know, people were just like, well, we get it. It was a window, you know. Maybe it's going to be a little later. So Miller kind of gets together and you know, scribbles down some stuff on the back of an envelope and decides, you're right. It's totally wrong. Totally wrong. It's actually going to be April 18th, 1844.
Oh.
He realized he used the wrong calendar, you know? And so it's like, okay, you know, that set me off by almost a month. So, April 18th, 1844, still no Jesus. In the Advent Herald on April 24th, Joshua Himes writes that all the expected and published time had passed, and he admitted that they had been mistaken in the precise time of the termination of the prophetic period. Josiah Litch surmised that the Adventists were probably, quote, only in error relative to the event which marked its close. This is a guy that he's starting to advocate now that maybe we were not understanding what cleanse the sanctuary meant. I don't know do you remember the Harold Camping end of the world prediction? This is
yes.
Very similar.
Yeah. Yes.
Is after his date passed. You know, he went into silence for a long time.
Yeah.
And then when he finally came back out, he said, the cleansing of the sanctuary happened. It just, we thought it would happen on earth, but it actually happened in heaven.
That's right. You yeah. know? I so, remember that. And he like hid out for a long time, right? Before
yeah,
he came back like, and said that.
Right.
Yeah.
So Miller published a letter that was called To Second Advent Believers, writing, quote, I confess my error and acknowledge my disappointment, yet I still believe that the day of the day of the Lord is near, even at the door. Then, in mid-August, a guy named S.S. Snow argued that the 10th day, of the seventh month of the 10th day of the seventh month, which is Yom Kippur, which happened to fall on October 22nd, 1844. That would be the day. Because, like, how could Jesus ignore Yom Kippur? That's like, it's the Day of Atonement.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, right? It all makes sense.
It's really obvious to me now.
Well, yeah, after hearing all of this, it's like, well,
they should have just figured that out right away.
Yeah. But you can see how complicated this is.
I know. Right?
So Miller was, Miller and Himes were both, they're both like, I don't know about this. I don't know about this October 22nd thing. But eventually they came around. October 26th, they both published their support for the October 22nd. That was like the height of the Millerite fervor of an end date. You know, that's mm-hmm. where like people were like up on mountains waiting to be like raptured and nothing happened. And that's what is now referred to as the Millerite Great Disappointment.
Can you imagine being related to that family? And that's like your claim to fame.
It's like, yeah, my my great grandpa, he was William Miller, who was a real big disappointment. So what ended up happening was, you know, the Millerite groups ended up kind of, you know, they're fracturing. You know, there are people who, you know, believe that the end time was still, like, we're still living in the end time. We just don't know the date. And then some other people were like, well, I don't know, maybe it's not, you know. Mm-hmm. So they fractured into a number of different groups. And as I think I mentioned in that previous episode, one of those fragments ended up becoming the Seventh-day Adventists.
Yep. That's where you brought the. That's where we heard this before.
Right. Right.
Yeah. That's
so,
right.
So that's the detail of the Millerites.
Wow.
And there's some more stuff connected to Millerism that I'm definitely going to get into some more.
Millerite sounds like Miller Lite.
Well, where
which would you rather have?
What would I rather have in my fridge, a Miller Lite or a Millerite?
Yeah.
I'm not going to go on record with that one. So what do you got?
Well, don't you think that if your name is Elizabeth Bathory, that you should probably be bathing in some blood?
Elizabeth Blood Bathory.
Yeah, the Blood Countess. I'm going to tell you a story about the worst female serial killer of all time. Who?
Worst as in, like,
numbers.
Most successful.
Most successful.
So really, in a way, kind of the best female serial killer of all time.
Well, she's really good at it. She was so good at it that she inspired some big shit.
They say you should do what you love.
Do what you love.
You'll never work
it a lot.
Yeah, do what you love. You'll never work a day in your life.
She's the inspiration for Bram Stoker's Dracula.
All right. You have my full undivided attention.
So that's legit. Right?
You have my full undivided attention.
All right. Her real name was Erzsébet Báthory. She's more commonly known here as Elizabeth. She's born in 1560 to one of the most powerful Protestant families in Hungary at the time. She was the daughter of these two people. I don't want to say their names because they're long.
Impossible to pronounce.
Impossible to pronounce. All you need to know is that there was some serious inbreeding. They both had the same last name of Báthory. So as a result, Elizabeth suffered from seizures, loss of control, and fits of rage. As a child, she witnessed the brutal punishments handed out by her family's officers. Her dad was a baron, and her mom was a baroness, on their estates. One anecdote describes a gypsy, which I know now is not the term to use. I don't know what the replacement is for gypsy.
Oh, yeah. Is that like a culturally insensitive thing?
Yeah. Okay. I don't know what the replacement is, but at this time it was a gypsy accused of theft who was sewn up in the belly of a dying horse and left to die.
That would not be a great way to go.
Her family tree certainly included some disturbed canes.
Did that say dying horse, not dead horse? So dying. They just cut open a live horse. I mean, because of course the horse is, you stuff a person inside a horse and sew it up, like the horse isn't going to make it.
Right. Why are we laughing about that? Well, listeners know how we feel about horses. That being said, I don't advocate for this kind of death. I mean, I do think horses were brought into this world just so we could have glue and jello.
Yeah, you like jello, right?
But that being said, I'm not all about this. Just shoot them in the head.
I think everybody can agree that cutting a horse open, sewing a person inside of it is going too far.
I mean, run them ragged somehow. Don't be doing this. I don't even, just really shooting them or something seems better. Anyway. Okay, so she came from a group of pretty messed up people. One of her uncles was like, hey, let me teach you Satanism. And her aunt was like, let me teach you sadomasochism.
Oh, that seems like a great combo. I mean,
they go hand in hand.
That is chocolate and peanut butter.
So she got married when she was 15 to a count. Oh, boy.
He's not going to have a good run.
Frank Nadasti. Count Frank.
Count. Gonna live a short life in extreme agony.
Well, wait till you hear what happens after he dies. That's when the shit's gonna really hit the fan. He was a soldier. He would go on to lead the armies of Hungary against Ottoman forces threatening Central Europe. So after she got married, she became a mistress of an estate. They earned a reputation as being quite harsh. Building upon her own cruelty, it is believed that Frank showed her some of his own ways of punishing his servants. So he wasn't very kind. She had already come from unkind stock, so they were not the nicest of people.
They were like sharing ideas.
Yeah. And she had three girls and a boy. So although the Count participated in his wife's torture activities, which was torture to their servants.
So do you think that's like a kind of a case of like a little relationship management where he's like, well, I gotta participate in the things that she's into.
Yeah. I mean, I've known of some people have had to do that on other levels, but what's going to happen is, I'm just like tilting my hand like this, like,
Well, I mean, I think it's important in a relationship to, to try those things and make your partner feel like important and participate in the things that they're interested in.
And validated.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Elizabeth's husband died in the early 1600s, and not because she killed him. He died of natural, people didn't live very long back in those days. So she eventually moved to one of her castles in northwest Hungary, which is now Slovakia, and she began to surround herself with a cohort of servants to help her with her torture practices. Legend has it that one day an attendant girl was brushing Elizabeth's hair when she accidentally pulled too hard, and it tugged on a snag of her, so it snagged her hair. The Countess erupted in anger. She jumped up. She hit the girl with the back of her hand. The strike was too hard, and it made the girl bleed, and some of the blood was left on Elizabeth's hand. Later that night, Elizabeth noticed that the skin where the blood had been looked much nicer than the rest of her skin. And she was like, oh my God, I have found the fountain of youth, and it's not because of the Asians.
What?
The Asians are always thinking of these amazing skin things.
Oh, like
that Hanukkah mask.
Like ancient Chinese secret stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and there's this mask floating around right now that's like, oh, you're supposed to look amazing, you know, and it's always, it's Asian culture. Just trust me on it.
Okay.
But this was as a result of blood in Hungary. So she was like, hey, if this little bit of blood can make my hand look young and a whole bunch could restore youthfulness to my whole body, right?
Yeah, right. So, oh boy, okay, I see where this is going.
That's when she started to bathe in the blood of virgin girls. That's when she snapped.
So I have a lot of questions. I don't know if I want answers to any of them.
Oh, boy. Wait till
one,
you...
should I save my questions for the end?
Yeah, see if I answer it, and if not, I probably can, because I read a whole lot
about
this. All
right, so I'm just...
Tell me what you're wondering,
you
though.
You don't answer the questions. I'm going to ask them for myself and for the audience. So
okay.
We'll see if we, you know... How much blood does it take to bathe in it?
Uh-huh.
How many virgins, girls, are being drained?
650 total.
okay. Like, because it's like, well, you know, I'm sure somebody knows right off the top of their head, like, what the average amount of blood in the human body is. You know, I feel like it's like several pints or gallons, or I don't know.
I would guess a couple of girls for a bathtub full, right? I mean, well, I'm thinking like it depends on, you know, how much of a luxurious experience you want to have. Do you want to have like your arms up like on the bath? Then it's like, well, you got to get that pretty full. But if you're kind of like, oh, I'm going to just be really uncomfortably tucked in here, you could probably go with like one less girl for that bath and then save her for the next.
So according to the internet, the average adult weighing 150 pounds will have about 1.2 gallons of blood in their body.
And of course, these were girls. So like young
so
women.
A little, yeah. So and actually, so it says according to this, the average 80-pound child will have about 0.7 gallons. So maybe not quite a gallon out of each one of these. So like,
about 5 milk jugs, maybe 8 milk jugs. So I bet 10 girls for a bath.
Well, a very small bathtub will hold about 40 gallons. So I think she's sponge bathing this. I think she's got a bucket of blood and she's just like, you know, wiping herself down.
Yeah. Yeah. Like soaking.
Yeah, I don't see, cuz like I don't think she's like bubble bathing this.
Yeah, cuz that would be a mess to clean up.
Yeah.
And where do you,
and a lot of waste really, cuz like, you know, I mean,
mhm.
You know, like obviously she had access to plenty of young virgin girls, but they don't just grow on trees.
And if you're just sponging it on, then you can be a little more selective. Like, I'll use this much blood. Otherwise, once you're in a tub of blood, do you just get rid of all of it? Because then you've been already in it.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Seems kind of wasteful.
Yeah. So young women started to disappear from villages near and far, as well as children. Unhappy girls were lured to the castle with the prospect that they would find work. They would get to work at a castle.
Oh, yeah. Well, we got a use for you for sure.
Then they were never seen again. When they got there, they were locked up in the cellar while they awaited their torture. Elizabeth carried out much of it herself. She often beat the girls to death. Sometimes she would sew a girl's mouth shut, force her to eat her own flesh or burn her genitals. When she was too sick to get out of bed to beat them, Elizabeth would order her servants to bring up a girl to her quarters where she would bite their faces and shoulders. In other instances, she would stick needles underneath the girl's fingertips before cutting off the fingers of those who tried to take out the needles. So pretty soon, Elizabeth did start to run out of young women, like you were saying, because she had either already taken them or the villagers had started to hide their daughters out of fear that she would take them. This is when the Countess began to resort to noble girls, a decision that would ultimately lead to her demise. It was like now, right?
Who's going to have a problem with that?
I mean, once you start taking the rich ones, then people are going to start noticing. Yeah, it's like the white girl syndrome, right?
Yeah, wait a second.
No, what you were doing before, we knew about. I didn't really like it. Yeah, but you
just stick to the pores, okay?
Stick to the pores. And if she had stuck to the pores, she wouldn't have gotten in this little bit of trouble.
Well, and also if she hadn't been so gender biased.
Right. But see, of course, it was the blood of a young woman that inspired
that started
this.
It, yeah.
So I think she had in her head, right. You know.
Yeah. I wonder if she did any experimenting, you know, where she's just like, give me a dude in here. We'll see what happens. Like, I don't like the results.
Yeah, I don't like the results. Okay, I got to get it together. So she killed a noble girl in 1609, and Elizabeth tried to stage it as a suicide. And so the authorities, in quotes, because like, what did that look like in 1609?
Right, and wasn't she basically in charge anyway?
Yeah, like, so then somebody was like, okay, guys, I think we got to do something with this lady, you know. So during a night raid, officials searched the castle and discovered the dead bodies of young girls everywhere they looked.
Well, and I got to think, like, it's, you know, like, she probably thought she was above the law.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, or she was the law, you know, so it's like, why even bother hiding it?
Right.
You know?
It's like, somebody will take care of it at some point.
Yeah. And if not, I'm going to start removing things from them.
Right. One body was in the fireplace, not yet fully burned. Some of the girls were missing arms and eyes. So they took her to trial, and many testified against her, including her servants as well as some survivors. One girl suffered 200 blows before dying. I don't know how people got away. But one of the servants said that girls were tied up and beaten to death until their whole body was black as charcoal and their skin was battered and torn. Another servant admitted that she had taken red hot fire pokers and shoved them into the mouth of one girl. She said she placed her fingers in the mouth of another and pulled until the sides split open. Mm. Isn't this the worst?
This is the toughest one to listen to you've had in a while.
Finally, after they kept hearing more and more, Elizabeth and her servants were convicted on 80 counts of murder, although evidence shows that there were 650 females probably killed in total. Her servants were sentenced to death, but she was imprisoned for life in a room in her own castle.
Wait a second. I mean, okay.
Uh-huh. I knew you were... So the servants all got death and then she gets to live.
Yeah. It's like, hey, like the people who, like, were only doing this because they knew if they didn't...
They had no choice.
They were going to be on the other end of it. Like, they're the ones who get sentenced to death. Although you could also argue the way they were executed was probably a little, I mean, I don't want to use the word humane, but like, it probably was a better way out than leaving them in her hands.
Yes.
You know, but I mean, that doesn't make, like, it doesn't make me feel good about it, but she got to just live in her castle.
Well, she had a room. It was boarded up with tiny slits for food and air. And she lived there for only 3.5 years before she was found dead, lying face down on the floor. And they don't know what her cause of death was.
Okay.
Probably because somebody killed her. And then they just were like, well, what happened to her?
I guess she died.
Yeah.
Interesting, huh?
And after her death.
Oh, I mean, who do you think had a problem with her?
Like the people bringing her the food?
I mean,
she was probably trying to like bite their fingers as they were pushing it through.
I mean, I
just
I don't...
a drop. Give me just a drop of your blood.
Come on, I'm feeding you. I just need a little taste.
I got a wrinkle.
Just something to wet my tongue a little bit.
They were probably bringing her cats to chew on.
Maybe she died from like the DTs or something. Maybe it's like super addictive.
That's not the kind of pussy I want.
Oh my God, that is a horrifying story.
It is. My curiosity was, who was the worst female serial killer ever?
Oh yeah,
I was wondering because I've had a lot of conversations as of late with people about how you white dudes got a lot of problems.
Yeah, white dudes really do have problems.
They do. Yeah, they do. And you guys get all the power, so you get to have all the problems. So I was chatting with somebody. I was
more
like,
power, more power, more problems. God damn, I wish I would have got that out smooth.
I know, it would have been awesome.
More power, more problems.
So I started wondering that. I found this lady. I was like, oh, man, this is the worst woman. And just a completely entitled, you know. So
yeah, I mean, it's crazy what human beings are capable of when the controls are totally pulled off.
Yes. Yeah. And isn't that something to think about?
Yeah. Just like, think about this. Who are you when there are no consequences? You know, like if there's no consequence for anything you do, you've got the power to do just about anything with no consequence. Are you... You know, we're all following the rules. Do we all still follow the rules when we're not afraid of being put in jail or held accountable in some other way? Mm-hmm. I feel like most of us are. Most of us are.
I agree with
good
that.
People.
Yeah, you know? I think like, so too.
I think most of us don't torture people and drain their blood. I think that's the outlier.
And your Ray of Sunshine is going to be about some good people here.
Some really tremendously good people. So, when I got to Phoenix this last weekend, there were a bunch of things that just happened.
Hashtag vacation problems.
Yeah, we had some straight up hashtag vacation problems. We had some issues with some transportation. Somebody else had booked the hotel room and it was not in a favorable part of town. Sandy's relatives, who live in the Phoenix area, Pat and Wayne, came and picked us up and brought us to their place out in Sun City, which was just like a desert paradise. And
the pictures were lovely.
Yeah.
The pool.
It's a great, they have a great space. They're super accommodating. And then we had happy hour with their neighbors.
You got it.
Don and Helen.
Yeah, I was going to look at it because I'd written it down already. I'm so sorry, Don and Helen. Yeah, Eric really, he's had a few.
Yeah, and I'm super tired. I'm on like,
yeah.
I'm on only a couple hours of sleep. but we had just an awesome night hanging out with them, you know, and they really bailed us out and, you know, just made themselves available for all the stuff that we needed.
That's great.
So, I really can't wait until I can get back out there and hang out with them again, because it was really just a fantastic time, and they did so much for us this weekend. So really made what could have been like a tragic vacation.
Yes, it was very close to that.
Yeah, it was like teetering on a border, you know, and like they really came through, and it was just amazing. So
have a weird week.